And in this case, we have admitted that we probably should have terminated this teacher earlier. There were certainly warning signs. It's not as if they were completely disregarded. Indeed, at one point, Hyde Park Baptist Church actually held a form of hearing in which they said, Mrs. Teacher's Assistant, you can't just repeat these accusations to us on the sly. You're going to have to come in front of the teacher and repeat them so that she can confront her accuser, which she thought was horribly offensive.
That is horribly offensive. It's not a criminal case. It's a case involving her child.
It is.
Why does she have to confront her accuser? Why could she just confront the administrator of this organization?
Perhaps that's the best way to do it, Your Honor. And I don't know that we handled it perfectly. And that's why we have admitted that in this case, that we no longer contest that there is evidence that we were negligent. Would we do things the same way again? No. Did we fire this teacher after this incident? Yes. Within 2 days, within 48 hours after this incident, before there was any lawsuit, before there was CPS showing up knocking at the door, we did fire this teacher.
Did you fire her before you called CPS or after?
Actually, it was one of the people in CPS. Yeah, one of the people in the preschool that called CPS, not the administration of the school.
But at some point you knew about it, didn't inform the family. So did you fire her after you knew that someone inside the school had called CPS?
Yes.
So CPS was involved.
CPS was involved.
Probably
but the reason I mention this is because the Court of Appeals below criticized the church. And keep in mind, I'm not saying that what the church did was correct. I'm saying they were negligent. But they criticized them because they still kept her in charge even after receiving a report of this incident. Well, they received the report of this incident on Wednesday, and they fired her by close of day Friday. That's within 48 hours.
But you're here to complain about the award, right?
I'm sorry?
You're here to complain about the
you're
award.
You're here to complain about the damage award.
And specifically the mental anguish.
The mental anguish. And the reason that we make this complaint, Your Honor, is that this court, speaking through Justice Phillips, in the case of City of Tyler versus Likes, expressed two great concerns about mental anguish damages.
Well, let's talk about significant injury. How do we know if a bump on the head is a significant injury?
Well, Your Honor, I would say that almost by definition, a bump on the head is not a significant injury.
What if it appears 10 days later after the injury on radiology?
Your Honor, the reason that we attach the radiology report to our brief, not them, is because if you go look at that report, it is a negative report. Read the report. They literally say there is no finding. There is no finding of a misalignment. There is no finding of an abnormality. Now, you tape a BB to the head so that you know where the bump is, so you know where to look. It's like they tape a BB to the breast when you do a breast exam. And they say, we see the BB, but there's literally no finding to see anything. They do make a comment, because doctors get sued for medical malpractice, that maybe if you did a CT scan that's more sensitive, but it is a complete negative finding. And when these plaintiff's lawyers say that the radiology report still shows an injury 2 weeks later, that's just false. That's why we attach the radiology report to our brief.
In Likes, though, that the court did say that the analysis is far from exhaustive and that the opinion did not attempt the perhaps impossible task of determining a unified theory.
And we agree
and
with
so
that.
And so we've got a two, or at the time, I guess, a 1.5-year-old in a daycare, in a facility, who, according to the COA, the Court of Appeals opinion, this was not the first time this child was hit on the head or somewhere else by this particular person. Do you disagree with those statements?
Well, I disagree with the statement that they said that this child had been subject to prior mistreatment by the teacher, like a trip or prior verbal correction, and that this child was centered, was sort of brought out or focused of the child, of the teacher's wrath more than other children. Which I have to say, if you've ever taught a class full of kids, there's going to be one kid that's going to receive the object of your wrath. But Justice Guzman, in your question about City of Tyler versus Likes, this court did state that it is not providing an exhaustive list, and indeed this court state, you cannot, it's mental anguish is a hard thing to get your arms around. You cannot provide an exhaustive black letter line. These cases you get them, these cases you don't. So what they said is they said, and Justice Phillips erected what this court has now referred to as the framework for analysis, two big points you look at. Why are there two? Because there's two concerns. The first concern is mental anguish is so variable. Some children consider a dog absolutely terrifying. And if you have a dog, you better put him away. Other children love a dog because it's a puppy. Human reaction and mental anguish is so variable that when it comes to the legal duty to protect against mental anguish, it is extremely difficult.
And it's so difficult. Why should we second guess what the jury did here?
Well, Your Honor, if this is simply a jury question, well, then City of Tyler versus Lanks shouldn't have even been decided. You should have simply stated that in these cases when plaintiffs sue for mental anguish, we simply throw it to the jury and say, do you want to award mental anguish damages? But this is the scope of the legal duty. That is there a legal duty? Should we impose a special relationship or some sort of special duty in certain cases? And that's a matter for this court to decide. The second matter also goes to the jury question. The second concern that the court had in City of Tyler versus Lanks is that the quality of proof in mental anguish cases is always bad. I mean, it's just, whether it's a good mental anguish case or a bad mental anguish case, you have people taking the stand saying things like, I have mental anguish, or I think they have mental anguish. Well, why? Well, my best guess is it's because of what happened to them 2 years ago, what happened to them when they were a child. And this court stated that the quality of proof is so poor in these mental anguish cases that we generally adopt a rule that we do not allow recovery for mental anguish damages. Now, let's apply these two concerns to this case. How variable is mental anguish, the mental anguish experience, to children? It's extremely variable. For some children, it will be absolutely upsetting to get kicked by a horse and have their face need stitches. For me, it was one of the best days of my life because I got to tell all my friends, man, I had this great accident. Mental anguish, you got to be kidding. This was a badge of honor to go to school the next day with stitches on my face.
Well, what about the fact that this child was under the age of 2?
I think that is significant, and I think this court has to decide, are we going to take City of Tyler versus Likes, in which we specified certain cases as being the type that we want to award mental anguish damages in, and stretch it and say within that framework are special cases for little bitty children?
You have, like in any other case that where mental anguish might be an issue, a psychologist here, I believe, Dr. McCarthy, mm-hmm. testifying in a clinical sense about the effect of this trauma on this child, mm-hmm. and putting before the jury testimony that described the level of mental anguish. Why isn't that sufficient?
And that sounds so good. A psychologist coming in saying, I've looked at this child, I've conducted tests, I've conducted examination. Look at what that actually means. This court has decided to look beyond science and see if this is junk science. And I go to the question of the quality of proof, because in every case of injuries to a young child, one or two, you're going to have these sorts of problems. How do you know the child has an anxiety problem?
Do you object to the reliability of her testimony? And if not, what does that do to this case?
I didn't try the case. I wish the trial lawyer had objected. He did not.
Okay, and what does that do to your complaints about that?
It severely truncates my ability to complain to this court. I am limited solely to protesting that there is no evidence that rules out the concurrent or alternative causations on its face. That is, that they simply stated, did this child go through a divorce during this time frame? Yes, including multiple moving around and living arrangements. A flood of one home caused a move. In-law issues caused another move. An accident that was severe to send the child to the hospital, including dental surgery. How do you know these factors didn't cause this? Because the psychologist said, I thought about that and I ruled it out.
I'll interrupt you just a second. Are you arguing in regard to the damages found against Ms. Lowry? Are you arguing only in regard to the negligence finding against the church?
I'm arguing only with respect to the damages finding awarded against the church.
Against, all right.
And Mrs. Lowry should be liable for every bit of mental anguish.
Okay, so your argument is not that the mental anguish was not supported as to her.
Exactly right, Your Honor. And my argument is not that mental anguish damages are not recoverable. They're recoverable against the intentional tortfeasor.
Can you?
Following through on that, the jury charge asked whether the church was negligent in failing to supervise and in retaining her, as well as directly negligent in failing to tell the parents.
Right.
You had three negligence submitted in one issue. What damages would the church be liable for negligent retention? What damages arise from those, from that?
From this case, for negligent retention?
In any case.
Well, this case doesn't involve a significant bodily injury. If there had been a significant bodily injury.
But if you're not challenging the damages found against her,
Ms. Lowry,
it seems like that the damages from negligent retention would be the damages that were found against her.
I see. Your Honor, I now see what you're saying. The Court of Appeals adopted this exact approach. And my opponents call this the 1-2 punch. And it's basically joint and several liability. That is, these damages were appropriate against the intentional tortfeasor, and since there's joint and several liability, they're recoverable against you.
Should you have objected to the way questions, I think it was 6, was submitted, and if you didn't, what effect does that have?
Because it was broken. No, Your Honor, no need to object, because this is a no evidence complaint. That is, there's no evidence of significant bodily injury so as to allow the recovery, and a no evidence point.
Well, obviously parties disagree there. I mean, defendants will say there's never significant bodily injury, perhaps toward mental anguish.
Exactly. Exactly, Justice Medina, and that's why you want the jury to answer the questions. You want the jury to answer all these questions, not pull some of them back, so that when we courts of appeals work out them, we say, oh, you can recover that. We don't have to send the case back down to the trial court because one little question was pulled back. You want all the items of damages to be decided by the jury, and then post-verdict, you can challenge them by motion for JNOV or an appeal, which is what we're doing here. So I don't believe that there was waiver, so to speak, that canceled out our ability to complain of a no evidence point because of the failure to object to submission of a particular element of damages. And I would say that would be a very bad form to do that, because you want to encourage the trial courts to find all the various elements of damages when there's a disagreement as to whether they're recoverable or not. And then we can hash it out post-verdict and on appeal. We don't have to remand it for one trial because we withdrew one blank.
Can I ask you, Likes alludes to the possibility that mental anguish damages may be available where there's a high degree of culpability. And let's assume that there is evidence here of repeated and systematic bullying by this teacher. Is it your position that we can or cannot look at the cumulative effect of that course of conduct?
I don't think that you can look at that course of conduct.
Can you explain that, please?
Yes, I can. When the first of all, that's not the church. That's this teacher. So when you say persistent bullying, you're talking about an intent to persistently go after and bother this child. That's,
I'm talking about the church's knowing that had gone on a repeated basis.
The church's knowing of it is simply they hear third-hand reports of it, or I should say second-hand reports of it, and they have a duty to try to intervene and try to stop her. So that is a passive negligence. The jury did not find gross negligence by us. The jury did not find any type of intentional misconduct by us. In the past, this court has held that negligence alone is not the high degree of culpability. Perhaps this court's now going to decide in this case there's different flavors of negligence. That is, there's gross negligence, but that's not here. But you've got vanilla negligence, but this one is a little darker than vanilla negligence. Why would I submit that's inappropriate? Go back to Likes. It states we need some predictability for the law. Trying to figure out when mental anguish is going to occur is difficult. It's a subjective area. Negligence is very subjective. The proof about mental anguish damages is very subjective. In this case, the proof by the psychologist was things like this child does not hold a pencil strongly, so therefore they must have anxiety. This child does not lines up toys very systematically and always puts the same toys, always in a row, and that indicates an anxiety. This child hurts the dog, and that's an indication of anxiety. Therefore, the church must have caused this. That is a poor quality of proof that the court in the City of Tyler versus Likes is talking about. I'm not saying that it's improper, but the court in the City of Tyler versus Likes said we shift that to a highly culpable party that intentionally injures somebody. We're willing to shift that gray area of damages to a highly culpable party that intentionally hurts somebody, but we will not shift it to a negligent party. And that's why in Boyles versus Kerr they said we can't allow negligence, that subjective standard of liability, and mental anguish, that subjective standard of damages, to go together down the aisle. It's just a very gray area, and the law needs more predictability.
Counsel, you have about to run out of time. Your second issue is I'm having a hard time understanding. Is that a legal sufficiency issue? Is it factual sufficiency?
No, it is a no evidence legal sufficiency point, second point. And we are saying that there is
you
no.
You only have two issues here now, correct?
We have a total of three issues before this court.
All right, well, I'm not sure about that, but let's talk about your last issue.
Okay, my last issue, the comparative responsibility.
Yes,
Your Honor, I stand corrected. That is a factual sufficiency point. And you don't normally discuss factual sufficiency points here. What we say is that this court needs to set the standards for the Court of Appeals to conduct a factual sufficiency review. Right now, there are no standards in Texas. This legislation was passed in 1995 as part of tort reform.
You want us to set standards for this particular type case, and then what about the next type case? Would we have different standards for that, or are you asking us to set standards?
We asked for three standards.
For any case?
For any case. And that is, if you want to conduct comparative fault, look and see which one was actively at fault, which one was passively at fault. Look and see which one was criminal as opposed to merely civil. Look and see which one was intentional as opposed to merely negligent. Those types of standards, are those the only standards you can come up with? No. But I submit that those are three of the historic tests, and one of them is even found in the statute. 33013 very much draws a line between criminal misconduct and civil misconduct.
Thank you.
I know.
If the jury had answered to question number one, no, and found her negligent instead, would you still be arguing that the Court of Appeals erred in failing to reverse the apportionment finding? And does it make sense to say that employer fails to protect others from negligence is more culpable than employer fails to protect the employee from intentional conduct?
If the jury finding had been that the teacher was merely negligent.
Right.
Your Honor, that's such a tremendous land shift. I'm not sure I can fully answer your question on the fly.
Mm-hmm.
You would then have two people sued for negligent infliction of emotional distress, and neither one would be liable for mental anguish damages. I mean, you would just stop, I think.
Mm-hmm. Any further questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
The court is ready to hear argument from the respondents.
May I please the court? Ms. Higginbotham will present argument for the respondents.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court. The two questions raised by Hyde Park on this appeal have been answered by the Texas legislature and this court in support of the judgment. The trial court and Court of Appeals got it right. The judgment should be affirmed for three reasons. First, the Texas comparative responsibility statute rejects Hyde Park's position on apportionment. Second, under joint and several liability, Hyde Park is responsible for all damages. And third, uncontested child abuse supports an award for mental anguish damages. Petitioner glossed over two key facts about this case that are fatal to its claims. This child was abused under the care of Hyde Park for 6 months. Not one day, not one incident, for 6 months.
Ms. Higginbotham, we actually do get quite a few cases of abuse up here in parental termination situations and others, and sometimes it's pretty awful. How do you think this relates to those kinds of situations where there's drugs and there's broken bones and physical violence over the course of time?
Well, Your Honor, this court does deal with child abuse on a regular basis, and child care centers are going to be watching this decision to find out the answer to the question. When we know a teacher is abusive, when we know that a teacher is unfit and harming children, do we have an obligation to stop that from happening, or are we off the hook? Because the more abusive the teacher is under Hyde Park's rule, the less liable the daycare center is.
But I'm just wondering, relatively speaking, I don't disagree with you, but relatively speaking, I guess if this is $100,000 worth, some of these cases would be in the trillions.
No, Your Honor, the evidence at this trial was very clear. There were numerous teachers. There were at least four teachers that testified that this teacher was abusing this child for 6 months. According to the record in volume 6, pages 66 to 68, Shelley Miller, a lead teacher, reported witnessing this teacher push this child to the ground more than once prior to the incident that was the final injury in this case.
That would seem to warrant an award for malice or something of that type of conduct. And it seems here that the award was assigned to mental anguish because of that bad conduct.
Your Honor, the jury unanimously concluded that this teacher did act with malice, that she intentionally injured this child. And there was ample evidence of 12 years of reports that the directors of the center were aware that this was an abusive teacher. Now, this court has consistently applied the restatement of torts, section 448, in Nixon versus Mr. Property Management, in Delaney versus University of Houston, where Justice Hecht wrote the opinion, in Travis versus City of Mesquite, in Fan versus Pena, and in Golden Spread Council, which was another child abuse case. And that restatement says, when there's an intentional tortfeasor or a criminal actor, that is the superseding cause of injury, unless the negligent party knew or should have known that that criminal conduct was likely to occur. In this situation, the record is replete with evidence that Hyde Park knew for 12 years that this teacher was abusive.
Well, I understand what you're saying, and it's not to minimize anything that occurred, but it looks like, from what I see in the record, that while there was a bump on the head, to argue about whether it was significant or not, but you know, the notion, what if you got a teacher who maybe rather than throws a hip into a 1.5-year-old and knocks them down intentionally or otherwise, just berates children?
Yes, Your Honor.
So, you have a teacher, young 1.5-year-old, and the teacher is mean. Imagine that. I've had a few mean teachers. Does that justify, a pattern of meanness to a child? Would that justify $100,000 in mental anguish damages?
Your Honor, that would be a question for the fact finder, and there would have to be evidence to support an award for mental anguish damages.
In your case, it would be simply because of the acts of the hip into the child or tossing the child or something like that, where no injuries occur.
No, Your Honor, there were injuries to this child. This child had a head injury that was denied medical treatment that was visible on radio.
Of course, we would have to look at the medical records on that, and we can draw our own conclusions about whether that was an injury or not. Can we not?
Well, Your Honor, the jury concluded that it was an injury and awarded past medical expenses and past damages for physical pain and mental anguish. That was one of the questions put to the jury. And the bump on the head incident was heard when the child's head hit the floor by another teacher across the room. The child was crying in pain, was offered no medical treatment. There's no question this child suffered a head injury.
What if you have an abusive child that the school knew about? That you had a bully child that, contemporary in age to the others, and knocked the child down, bumped the head, and the school was aware of this child like that. I mean, does the same liability factors occur there?
No, Your Honor, it would be a somewhat different case because a bully child, a peer of the child, is not supervising the classroom. It is not an agent of the
negligent retention of an abusive child?
Well, Your Honor, certainly the school has an obligation to create a safe environment, as they contractually promised to do to this family. And the school has a special relationship to all of the children in its care. This court has traditionally found a special relationship exists when you have contracting parties, when one of them is more vulnerable than the other, and the other party knows it. In this case, you have a school that's taking care of young children. If the school is aware that a situation is dangerous, they have a legal obligation to act. Now, whether that's a child or a teacher, they have a responsibility and a duty to respond. But it's worse in a case like this when it's the teacher who's in charge of that classroom, who's supervising the children.
Do you believe there are several likes factors that apply here, several categories of likes, or just one, or some hybrid of more than one? Or
yes, Your Honor, there are several likes categories that apply here. As the Court of Appeals below found, the malice of the teacher, based on the intentional tort finding, could apply, and that would end the inquiry there.
Seems like, though, for Hyde Park, they only found negligence. So how are we imputing the malice from the teacher to the Hyde Park to support the discussion?
Well, Your Honor, the court is not imputing malice to Hyde Park in this situation. Rather, Hyde Park is responsible for its own conduct, which is being aware of the criminal conduct of the teacher and doing absolutely nothing to stop it.
Nonetheless, the jury just said negligence.
Yes, Your Honor.
Gross negligence.
Negligence in retaining a teacher that it knew to be a criminal, knew to be abusive.
But that's not in the jury charge. Is it? I mean, I've got the jury charge here. Maybe I'm missing something.
The question 3 on negligence for Hyde Park was whether Hyde Park was negligent in supervising and retaining Ms. Lowry. And in order for Hyde Park to be negligent, we have to prove that Hyde Park both gave the opportunity for the abuse by keeping the teacher in the room and that Hyde Park foresaw the abuse. Foreseeability is where all of these cases turn. If it's not foreseeable that this third party is going to commit a crime.
But you don't have to prove malice to prove negligence. And your argument here is that the award of $100,000 was because they negligently and maliciously retained this teacher.
No, Your Honor. In this case, the award is because there were damages inflicted by child abuse, of which there are two causes that work together in conjunction. It is standard tort doctrine that there can be more than one cause.
I understand that. Perhaps you should just leave the word malice out of your argument so we can focus on the award being supported by the evidence of the bump on his head that lasted 10 days after the injury and the medicals that was submitted?
Certainly that's a basis to find support for the mental anguish damage award, serious injury to the child, but it's not necessary. If this court declined to find serious bodily injury, it could find the teacher's abusive act supports the mental anguish damage award.
This Let's court, talk about the serious injury just a little bit more before you go to the other points. Like says that minor physical symptoms are not serious bodily injuries that can form the basis for recovering mental anguish damages. Anytime there's any kind of injury, even slight, to a child, you're worried. How do you apply, first, do you think that holding in likes applies here? And second, what's your argument that there's a serious physical injury here?
Well, Your Honor, as you noted, likes held and stated that mental anguish damages are recovered in virtually all personal injury cases.
And you cite that in your brief. The very next statement in likes says, quote, where serious bodily injury is suffered, we know that some degree of physical and mental suffering is the necessary result. And the end of that paragraph, the holding says, there must be serious bodily injury to form the basis for recovering mental anguish damages. So likes does say what you say, but it also adds other explanatory sentences following it.
Well, likes does not create a requirement that there be serious bodily injury to recover mental anguish damages. It gives an example of categories of damages, one of which is serious bodily injury, where mental anguish damages are
traditionally. That's the one I'm talking about.
Yes, Your Honor. Now, in this case, we certainly could argue, and the jury did find this child suffered physical pain and suffering. There was testimony from multiple teachers that this child was physically abused by this teacher on a regular basis for 6 months.
Where do you draw the line between injury and serious physical injury?
Your Honor, that's a question that needs to be left to fact finders, because this court has never attempted to define what is serious bodily injury. Because there's a number of ways people could be seriously injured. The court wouldn't want to give an exhaustive list of how many ways one's personal body could be injured. But this court doesn't have to find that there was serious bodily injury in this case. In fact, this court's decision in Adams versus YMCA in 2008 involved no physical injury to a child, but it was a child abuse case. This court has never reviewed a child abuse case and found that mental anguish damages are not supported by the evidence.
Putting aside serious bodily injury, you believe there is a special relationship under likes?
Yes, Your Honor, there is. When there's a contractual relationship between two parties, when one of those parties is more vulnerable than the other, and the other party knows it, which is exactly the situation here, courts have found special relationships to exist. Courts have found special relationships with institutions, where the state of Texas has been found to have a special relationship with a child in a foster care agency type relationship. There are times when an agency or an individual is standing in the shoes of a parent, like a child care center, and a parent-child relationship is consistently recognized to be a special relationship. This daycare center has taken on the mantle of providing safe care for children, young children under the age of 2 who can't speak, and they have an obligation to make sure they're outfitting their center with teachers who are fit and appropriate to be around children. The evidence shows that this child care center knew that this teacher was abusive for over 12 years, almost terminated her several times, had teachers being asked to be removed from her classroom, refusing to teach with her anymore. There's no question that this crime and this intentional tort was foreseeable by Hyde Park. Counsel told you Hyde Park even had a mini trial about her conduct, in which the very type of abuse that was perpetrated against this child was discussed. The management was extremely aware of what this teacher was capable of, but made a decision to do absolutely nothing. They kept her in the classroom, they didn't increase supervision, they didn't change anything about her classroom environment, and it was foreseeable that she would go on to abuse another child.
It's all conceded, though, isn't it?
It is conceded, Your Honor, and that is why the apportionment award is supported under Chapter 33. The apportionment argument that Hyde Park raises is that as a matter of law, a negligent tortfeasor can never be more responsible than an intentional tortfeasor, and that is not the law as contemplated by the legislature or by this court. And if this court upholds the apportionment finding, then Hyde Park is responsible for all damages that flow from those injuries under joint and several liability. Now, the court could look to both the text of the statute, which is Section 33.003, which states that both negligent and intentional tortfeasors are considered together. There's no exception to that apportionment. Hyde Park is asking this court to create a new rule that it would be difficult to implement in practice. They want to weigh active versus passive conduct, criminal versus non-criminal conduct. That's unworkable in the framework of the statute.
Counsel, I agree with you to an extent. Chapter 33, section 003A in particular says the jury is the trier of fact is to allocate percentage of responsibility according to the contributing to the harm. Okay, so I'm not sure it necessarily depends on whether it was intentional or negligent, because someone could negligently cause more harm than an intentional act may have caused, and the statute refers to apportioning responsibility based on the harm that's caused, not the mens rea, at least not in the wording of the statute. However, that still leaves the question, it seems difficult to argue or to support a harm caused by a direct physical act that the jury found to be intentional being less responsible for the harm caused than someone who was supervising the party who did the intentional physical act. Doesn't that seem backwards to you, that the negligent actor in this context was found four times more responsible than the intentional actor?
No, Your Honor, it does not. And the reason is this court has addressed this very issue in a number of cases by following the restatement section 448, which says normally a criminal act is the superseding cause of an injury to someone unless the negligent party knew or should have known and has a duty to prevent that act from happening. In Nixon versus Mr. Property Management, an apartment complex owner left vacant and was not following a Dallas City ordinance to keep doorknobs and locks on doors. And it was in an area that was a high crime area and many violent crimes had occurred there. And the court concluded that because the landlord was aware of the crimes, because the landlord was aware they were violating an ordinance, that the fact that a subsequent rape occurred there was foreseeable. And that landlord was negligent in that case.
If the answer had been flipped, if it had been 80-20 the other way, would there be evidence to support that?
Your Honor, that question could have been answered that way by the jury. And Hyde Park
argued
that.
Is there any answer the jury could have given to that question other than zero that would be supported by the evidence?
Well, Your Honor, we argue the great weight of the evidence certainly supports the judgment as answered.
There would be some evidence.
But there was some evidence of two causes.
Support any answer they gave.
Correct, Your Honor. That's so correct. What? As long as the answer wasn't zero.
As long as it wasn't zero.
Yes, Your Honor.
So would you address opposing counsel's position that we ought to set some kind of standards for the courts of appeals to use in evaluating the weight of the evidence in these cases?
No, Your Honor, the standards
they're asking for us, they want it remanded for the court of appeals to reweigh and for there to be some standards other than just looking at the totality of the evidence and deciding whether it's enough or not.
Right. And, Your Honor, the answer is the standards already exist. The Court of Appeals did weigh the factual sufficiency of the evidence. And
what standard did it use?
Well, in that case, Your Honor, the Court of Appeals would look to the great weight of the evidence and determine.
What standard would we give the trial court and the juries to follow? We have an appellate. Factual and legal sufficiency, but what guidance do we give the jury and the trial court to follow?
Well, Your Honor, the trial court and the court of appeals below can do both a legal sufficiency and a factual sufficiency review.
So we tell the trial court, just do something that won't get you reversed. We need to give them a little more guidance than that, don't you think?
Yes, Your Honor, the guidance is already there. And
I was a trial judge, and I always tried to do things that wouldn't get me reversed. But it always was quite helpful if I had a little more guidance than that. And in many areas, this court had provided that area. What guidance would be helpful here?
Well, the guidance, Your Honor, is already there in both the factual sufficiency standard of review and the legal sufficiency standard of review. And both of those are greatly deferential to the jury. The legal sufficiency standard of review is, as long as there is some evidence, any scintilla of evidence to support the verdict, then it should be undisturbed. The factual sufficiency standard is also very hard to meet. The Hyde Park conceded in its briefing in the court below that it was a very tough standard. As long as there's some evidence, the court defers to the jury's finding. In this case, Hyde Park has not preserved for this court to review whether the evidence was sufficient or not. It waived the objections to the expert at trial. There were no objections to the expert testimony at trial. And and in this petition for review, Hyde Park did not preserve.
Would you concede that your argument that legal and factual sufficiency standards are not sufficient if you're looking at punitive damages, for example? Ability, we have net worth, we have lots of guidance for the jury. It doesn't work there.
Well, Your Honor, that...
Need anything more here?
Your Honor, that issue is not before this court today. The jury wasn't asked about...
I agree. But by analogy, we've got a lot more guidance there, don't we? Mm-hmm. With punitive damages.
Yes, Your Honor.
And instructions to the jury?
We also have more guidance from the legislature that has made specific requirements for findings and very specific
instructions.
Regardless
of the source, we have more guidance. But we don't need any more guidance here.
No, we do not, Your Honor, because the legislature has spoken on this issue in Chapter 33. The legislature has carved out exceptions, for example.
And I understand, but in just taking off from your answer to Justice Heck's question about any number other than zero would have some support. So if the jury said 99% on Lowry, 1% on the church, you would say that's justifiable. That's supported.
Your Honor, that certainly wasn't our position, but it could be argued that that's
the jury said 99% on the church and 1% on Lowry, you would say that's supported.
Yes, Your Honor.
And the public at large and the world would go, what is going on here? If a court of law can say diametrically opposed results are both right.
Well, Your Honor,
without providing more guidance.
I certainly do not think that on this evidence it would be right to put 1% on the center and 99% on the child.
It's legally sufficient. If the evidence supporting it is legally sufficient, it would be affirmed on appeal.
Let me make my position,
your position
clear. No, Your Honor, let me make my position very clear. The evidence supports this apportionment. The great weight of the evidence was the church knew for 12 years this teacher was abusing children. Every decision by this court that has looked to whether an intentional tortfeasor can be less responsible than a negligent tortfeasor has looked to foreseeability. That's the key to answering the question. If the negligent party has a duty and the negligent party can foresee that the intentional conduct is likely to occur and has the ability to control that situation, then the apportionment can be shifted so the negligent party is more responsible. The key to that is this is not, these two people are not strangers. Ms. Lowry is Hyde Park's employee. They have the right to control her work. They know what she's doing. They set the standards. They were aware that she was abusing children for 12 years. And I see that I'm out of time. May I finish my answer and briefly conclude?
If you can briefly sum up, counsel.
Okay. Because Hyde Park knew for 12 years that this teacher was abusing children, and Hyde Park does not dispute that it negligently failed to supervise and retain this teacher. Hyde Park, under joint and several liability, can be responsible for the damages. Hyde Park is confusing vicarious liability and joint and several liability. Under joint and several liability, Hyde Park is responsible for the damages that occurred that flow from its negligence in retaining a known abusive teacher. For all these reasons, we respectfully request that this court affirm the courts below.
Thank you, counsel. The court will hear rebuttal.
Do you agree or disagree that under likes, the special relationship category would apply in a daycare situation?
Oh, no, Your Honor. I don't think it would apply at all. In Texas, the special relationship has only been applied to one relationship between doctor and patient. And it's so confined that when the patient has tried to say, I have a special relationship with the hospital, the courts of appeals, for example, in Veronica said, no, you can have a special relationship with a person that you have an intimate relationship where they need to make sure you don't suffer mental anguish. But an institution, we're not going to impose that special relationship. It is very confined. Now, what would happen if this court did recognize a, quote, special relationship? It would stand about 300 years of jurisprudence on its head. And what I mean by that is, as my opposing counsel said, these teachers were somewhat in the place of the parents. And for many, many years, preschools were viewed as in loco parentis. They're in the place of the parents. And so it was, courts were hand off on how people parent their children, or if they place somebody else in their place, it's hands off. If they decide they're going to hold milk up to a child's face and make him drink his milk, believe it or not, that didn't used to be evidence of abuse. If this court says, instead of following 300 years of jurisprudence, where we don't get into the details of how you discipline kids, which is sloppy. It's not like this court where everything is ordered. You've got spills here, and you've got one kid shoving another kid over here. If you pay attention to this, you leave the spill there. It's sloppy. If this court decides it's going to go the opposite direction of in loco parentis, and instead say there is a special legal relationship where this court will intervene between child and the preschool, and we will actually have evidence that when you force the child to drink milk, that's abuse. When she says they knew abuse was going on for 12 years, that's what she's referring to. There were these incidents. Now keep in mind, what happens during 12 years? You don't just record incidents of abuse. You have everybody's happy with the construction project. One of the evidence is this teacher was particularly good at caring for a child that had spina bifida and needed special training by the teacher to care for this child. Over 12 years, if you knit and pick and pull out a complaint, just like you could with a member of this court, if you go over 12 years, you can find a mistake here and a mistake there, and you push it together and say, they knew about it for 12 years.
Not this court.
I'm sorry. I meant the court across the hall. What they knew about is things like tripping a child. Well, I submit, for example, that if justices on this court were to serve as, for example, Little League coaches and supervised Little League coaches, I'll bet you could find some years where they grabbed a kid or threw him up against the fence because they ran the bases, or threw a bat again and again and again, and you can't throw a kid. Now, is the court going to intervene in all of these little details to where every little incident? Yes, they will if there's a significant bodily injury. If a kid actually gets hit by a bat, if a kid actually gets hit when they're pushed up against a fence.
Well, the intervention would be if we accept the jury's verdict here, it would come when a teacher intentionally shoves a kid off a stool and hits, you know, to cause that kid's head to slam against concrete. That seems to be an appropriate point of intervention.
It is, Your Honor. And keep in mind that these arguments that they, and the position they've argued today, would be perfectly fine before 1995, before tort reform came in. But when tort reform came in, they did not like joint and several liability. That was the main target that they had, is the deep pocket employer gets hit mainly because they have deep pockets. Look at the statute, not just 33003, but look at 33013. The Texas legislature actually said, when does a person become responsible for another person engaging in intentional injury to a child? It's when they act in concert with them. So 33013 actually says, a person will be jointly and severally liable with a person that injures a child or injures an elderly person. There's all sorts of crimes. They will be jointly and severally liable to them if they act in concert with them.
Well, maybe, you know, you talk about deep pockets. Maybe it's because the employer's in a better position to put a stop to that abusive situation. And maybe when they fail to act, they are acting in concert.
Well, Your Honor, they don't have a jury finding that they acted in concert. I hear what you're saying about maybe the school's in the best position to stop it. And what I can say, Your Honor, is if I tell you that I may push this pen off this table, I may do it. I'm telling you, I may do it. And I finally push this pen off, can I hold you responsible? You're a member of this court. You can command the bailiff to come in here and stop me. And you didn't stop me.
Right back there.
Are you more responsible than me? You may have some degree of responsibility, but are you more responsible than me?
Well, I think your whole analogy is
incorrect. So what is it, would it be your position that the maximum the employer in this case could be liable for would be 50%, more than half for the actor, up to that amount?
I think that is being extremely generous. I can't imagine that a intentional wrongdoer and a negligent wrongdoer could be equally at fault.
So how much should we, what is the cutoff in your view?
I think, Your Honor, and this is, you're asking for my view. I don't know if it'll be this
one. So you're here arguing your client's case, and you're telling
I
us,
am, and I'm
you
saying in the,
right
in the average,
what do you want us to say?
In the average negligent supervision case, I'm not talking about where an employer consistently hires incompetent people.
In your case,
the most they can impose is 50%.
50-50.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. The cause is submitted. That concludes the arguments for this morning, and the marshal will adjourn the court.
All rise.